From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Miroslava Gongadze, chief of VOA's Ukrainian service. Our topic on this edition of the program, Moscow's attempts to influence European politics and policy. Our guest, Alina Polyakova. She's deputy director of the Eurasia Center at the Atlantic Council and senior fellow of Future Europe Initiative. Alina Polyakova is co-author of a paper entitled Kremlin's Trojan Horses, which documents Russian influence in France, Germany, and the United Kingdom. The paper argues that since Putin's return to power in 2012, the Kremlin has accelerated and deepened its efforts in political warfare once used by the Soviet Union that aimed to influence world events through the manipulation of media, society, and politics. The Kremlin strategy consists of disinformation campaigns, the export of corruption and kleptocratic networks, economic pressures in the energy sector, and the cultivation of a network of political allies in European democracies. Speaking of which, key elections in France, Germany, and the Netherlands will be taking place in the coming months. Right-wing anti-establishment nationalist parties are on the rise and feel emboldened in the aftermath of Brexit, Britain's decision to leave the European Union, as well as the election of Donald J. Trump here in the United States. Anti-immigration policies, strong border controls, and disdain for the bureaucrats of the European Union bind together the various groups from France's National Front, or Le Front National, led by Marine Le Pen, the Netherlands' Freedom Party, and Germany's Alternative for Germany Party. We'll talk with Alina about the rise of these populist movements in Europe, the extent to which they are directly financed and buttressed by Moscow, and prospects for making inroads or outright victory. We'll also examine EU reaction to the election of U.S. President Donald Trump, given his penchant, both during and after the campaign, for criticizing European Union allies, such as German Chancellor Angela Merkel, and praising Russian President Vladimir Putin. Putin is widely seen by consecutive Republican and Democratic administrations, as well as by Republican and Democratic members of Congress, as an adversary, determined to undermine European unity and NATO and erode Western values. Analysts say he has already upended the post-World War II order by annexing Crimea and destabilizing eastern Ukraine. More recently, the U.S. intelligence community has determined that Vladimir Putin's Russia interfered in the U.S. presidential election to hurt Hillary Clinton and benefit Donald Trump. Alina Polyakova, who has frequently appeared on my Encounter program, joins us now at the VOA Broadcast Center as our special guest on Press Conference USA. Alina, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Carol.
And I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, Miroslava Gongadze.
Happy to be here.
Alina Polyakova, let's first talk about the findings in your report, the Kremlin's Trojan Horses, all the more critical now as we face elections in France, Holland, and Germany, regarding Moscow's influence with these far-right parties.
Well, the main findings of the report, if you can call them that, is to really bring to light the network and extensive web of political connections that the Kremlin has built over the last decades, essentially since Putin has come to power, which has been almost 20 years at this point, with like-minded political parties, political leaders, and also business interests, not just in Central Eastern Europe, which is the region most people tend to look at when it comes to Russian influence, but even encroaching far, far into Europe's core, Germany, France, and the UK. I say in terms of findings, if you can call them that, because nothing in this report was actually new in a sense. All this information is out there. It's out there in open source information, in media reporting, and it's been there for years. Everybody knows, for example, that Gerhard Schröder, of course, the Social Democrats of Germany, former head of the party and chancellor, now works for chairman of Gazprom. So clearly there's a relationship there because he moved into that position directly after leaving office. So it's things like this that we haven't really put together to show there's a profound pattern here. It's not just one-off connections, friendships, business ties here and there. It's really about a much broader pattern of how Russia under Putin seeks to exert its political power across the West.
So then what is the Kremlin's main goal in your view, and why should we be concerned?
Well, I think the Kremlin has multiple order goals when it comes to different countries. One thing that we talk about in this report as well is that the Kremlin's active measures or toolkit of influence is very tailored to specific countries. The toolkit is the same, right? It's disinformation, it's political networks, it's playing games with the energy sector by shutting off gas to some countries like they did with Ukraine, for example. But at the same time, they can't implement all of these tools in Germany and in Ukraine in the same way. So what they do is they find key vulnerabilities and then match the specific tool of influence to exploit that vulnerability. And when I say the aims are different, in Western Europe, I think the Kremlin's aims are pretty clear. It's to undermine NATO, and then it is to destabilize the EU to the point where EU member states could no longer have a consensus or a clear policy towards Russia. I don't think it's within the Kremlin's interest to have an EU that's completely fallen into economic disarray. The EU is one of the largest trading partners for Russia. So this would, of course, very negatively affect the Russian economy, which already has been in stagnation and decline for quite some time. But the purpose here is to undermine EU from a political perspective, to undermine the consensus, and to sow doubt about the value of democratic principles more broadly.
Alina, you're sounding alarm about this influence of Russian propaganda in Eastern Europe, in Western Europe. Why do you think only now the Western community realize how serious this influence is, and why for so many years everybody looks like they were asleep, not really reacting to that disinformation?
I think there's a few reasons for that. I do think that Central Eastern European countries, particularly countries like Ukraine, the Baltic states, Georgia, who have been the targets of Russian aggression specifically, have been dealing with this for years. I mean, Ukraine had its first very public cyber attack on its electoral systems in 2004, 2005. And so even though average Americans, for example, were probably taken by surprise when many of these revelations came out about the cyber hacks of the DNC and Russia's potential attempts to influence the elections, countries like Ukraine have been dealing with this for, you know, over a decade at this point. And what we've seen the Kremlin do is test some of these techniques in these countries that are not part of NATO, not part of the EU, that are more easy targets from the point of view of Russia. And I think for Western leaders, why have they been asleep? Which I agree with you, they have been. I think there was a certain hubris, to be honest with you, that Western countries have strong democratic institutions, we have independent media, we have safeguards against foreign influence. And yes, that can happen, you know, in the backwater, quote unquote, of the post-Soviet space or even Central Eastern Europe, but it could never happen in Germany. It could never happen in France. It could never happen in the U.S. But of course it has, and it is happening.
Indeed. And let's get to that point, because there are elections in France, as I alluded to in my introduction, in Germany and the Netherlands. What are the concrete implications for these elections of Moscow's intervention?
And we're thinking a great deal about this, as I'm sure many people are, particularly our European friends and colleagues. I think that it would be smart and relevant for European governments to learn from the U.S. experience as to how to approach a potentially similar situation in their own elections. Now, if we look at this year, we have the Netherlands in March, the first major European elections. Right after that, we have the French presidential elections, April, May. And of course, the biggest of them all, I think, in terms of European security, are the German elections in the fall. And in this particular moment, there is a great deal of uncertainty given these unpredicted events that we've seen so far. Brexit wasn't predicted. President Trump's victory wasn't predicted by most pollsters. And so I think looking at what can or cannot happen in Europe, we really can't say, you know, certainly that Merkel will win, for example. She has a very difficult battle ahead of her. And I think if European leaders, European members of the intelligence community look at what happened in the U.S., one lesson that they will learn is that we were taken by surprise. There's a lot of doubt and questions as to what Russia actually did, whether the hackers were affiliated with the Russian government. All the intelligence agencies in the United States have agreed that, in fact, yes, we can attribute the hacks to the Russian government. But then again, there's a lot of confusion in the United States. I think one reason for that was that the public wasn't prepared. We have spent a long time in this country underestimating Russia and its goals and interests and capabilities to influence our politics. And we really didn't see this coming. And I think if Europeans are able to start a public debate, a real conversation to raise public awareness about this threat and danger, then if something does happen, people will not be so distrustful of the mainstream media or of their government representatives, and maybe there won't be as much confusion about what happened and what did not happen. Of course, there's also probably technical aspects of the hack that European intelligence communities could learn from the United States as well.
I don't want to take from the topic, but it seems to me we are giving a lot of benefit to Russian influence. In the same time, there is some other probably natural issues that Europe, let's say, have that bring that far right and far left or more divisive positions for the public. How would you comment that? Do you really think that Putin was the key influence on that views?
He seems to be just capitalizing on all that.
No, I actually think it's absolutely right. When we were talking about this question of Russian influence, Russian goals, Russian aims for the West, clearly a lot of what's happening in Europe and in the United States is domestically driven. You know, our election pointed that very clearly, that we have a country that's very divided, that's being driven by different interests, the voters have different views of the world and their place in it. And the same is happening in Europe as well. Populist parties that Miroslava mentioned have been around Europe for a very long time. This is not a new occurrence, but they've been slowly gaining steam and capitalizing on divisions within European societies, the economic stagnation that Europe hasn't really come out of since the financial crisis, and of course, the refugee crisis that has brought up a lot of questions about culture and identity, and other questions about the future of Europe. So it's clear to me that these populist parties specifically are being driven by domestic changes. But Russia's role is not to be a puppet master in all this, it's to fan the flames, is to find the opportunities, ways to exploit them to its own advantage. And that is something that the Kremlin has proven to be very, very good at. And I want to share, you know, one rather disturbing statistic that I read today. It's from a recent Chatham House report where they did a survey of about 10 European countries looking at attitudes. And I think the most disturbing piece that I saw in that was they posed the statement to respondents that said, all Muslim immigration should stop. Do you agree or disagree? The huge majority of Europeans agree. 70% in Poland, over 60% in France, over 50% in Germany. And what populist parties have been very good at is using people's fears about immigration and their fears about security risks and threats from potential radicalized individuals that are coming in with those flows to undermine the centrist parties and their control on policy.
Of course, a great irony is that Russia intervened in Syria and actually just fanned the flames of that conflict on behalf of Bashar al-Assad, which in turn fueled the refugee crisis. So he's both a cause of it and a beneficiary to some extent insofar as he's siding with the far-right populist parties who are enraged.
That's absolutely right. And I think it's been a very strange discourse to observe in the refugee question in Europe, where it's very disconnected from the causes of the refugee flows. It's this perception, well, the refugees are here, what do we do? Well, if European leaders and if the United States was willing at some point to take a stronger policy, a different policy in Syria, perhaps some of this could have been prevented. But there is a real disconnect, I think, in our public discourse. And I think many analysts and experts who've looked at the Middle East have been very, very frustrated with the lack of Western response to the unfolding humanitarian crisis. And now we're suffering from that.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Alina Polyakova. She's deputy director of the Eurasia Center at the Atlantic Council. That's a think tank here in Washington. And she's senior fellow in the Future Europe Initiative. I'm Carol Castiel, along with Miroslava Gongadze. She's chief of VOA's Ukrainian service. And this is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Rexvanula Swatik from Abbottabad, Pakistan. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, Alina, not only are perhaps establishment leaders in Europe concerned about Vladimir Putin, but also how about the new president here in the United States, whose positions vis-a-vis Russia, Mr. Putin in particular, are very different from traditional Republicans and Democrats. Mr. Trump has made many conciliatory statements about Vladimir Putin. Even most recently, he seemed to draw a moral equivalency between Russia and the United States in an interview on Fox News. He said that Putin's a killer, but we have a lot of killers in America. This disturbed many people on both sides of the aisle. What's been the reaction in Europe?
Look, I think Europeans are very worried. They're concerned about what the new administration's foreign policy will be vis-a-vis Europe. They really don't know what's going to happen. I think there's a greater fear that the United States, which I would argue has been one of the greatest integrators of the European project all the way from World War II onward, will now become potential disintegrator, and if not a disintegrator, perhaps an ambivalent force in transatlantic partnership. So, of course, I think Europeans are going through a bit of a crisis. You know, what if the U.S. is no longer there as a reliable partner? I don't think we're quite there yet. I would just say that we should give this some time. We don't know what the policy will be. But at the same time, if there's an upside to this, perhaps European leaders who have been somewhat unwilling to really take responsibility for their own future, like, this will be the time for them to really step up and take that leadership position, which the United States has filled for decades.
Ukraine is possibly the most vulnerable country in this situation, and Ukrainian authority and basically Ukrainian society are afraid that Ukraine can be a bargaining chip between Russia and United States. Do you really think that President Trump, as he claims, can fix Ukraine-Russia problem?
Look, I think, like many administrations, this administration will also find that the reality is very different than the campaign rhetoric. The situation in Ukraine, as many people know right now, has escalated again to a full-out war. Obviously, the situation in eastern Ukraine has never been a frozen conflict as such. It's always been low-intensity warfare, where the last few weeks we've seen the heaviest fighting that we've seen in years. There's a lot of questions as to who's doing what, but I think it's relatively clear that the majority of the attacks are coming from the east, meaning from the so-called Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics that are, most experts' opinion, being controlled by the Kremlin to some extent. So I think once the Trump administration takes a deeper dive into the issues, if it tries to actually have a productive role, particularly in the Minsk agreements, American national security interests are very much linked to having stable partners, whether that be stable trade partners or stable partners for solving global challenges like terrorism, for example, which, of course, the administration sees as a top priority. Solving that top priority or making some productive headway into the fight against ISIS is not as easy as partnering with Russia and then letting the rest of the world go. What we've seen Russia do in this interventions in Syria is, of course, not fight ISIS. What we've seen Russia do is target civilians and hospitals and moderates, those groups that were being supported by the United States. And now we have a situation where Bashar al-Assad is taking more and more control of the country, and the rest of the country is being controlled by ISIS. And that is the outcome that the Russian government sought to affect in that region. And, you know, if we want to be the leading country fighting ISIS, then why would we partner with a country that's been de facto supporting ISIS in some ways, despite all the pretty public rhetoric that the Kremlin puts out there?
What do you think should be United States' role? Do you think that United States should be more forceful and active in the Minsk negotiation, maybe some other different type of negotiation? And do you think the Minsk agreement that we talk so much about is really working, or we do have to rethink and renegotiate that format?
I think it's clear to most people that have been following the conflict in Ukraine that the Minsk agreements were bad deal for the Ukrainians. They were basically forced to sign on to those under the gun. At the time, 2015, when the second agreement was signed, Ukrainians were dying by the dozens. What was any president to do at that time? if you can get a ceasefire and your people can stop dying, you sign that ceasefire. And most people in the West agreed that was not a good deal. And I think the Ukrainians were very disappointed that the U.S. did not take an active role in those negotiations, but that it was done in the Normandy format with only European leaders and Russia. I think the U.S. can still have an influential role. The U.S. can always have an influential role when it comes to foreign policy. But when it comes to Minsk agreements, even though they're a bad deal, European sanctions are tied to the fulfillment of Minsk. Those sanctions must stay on for Europe to have a coherent and unified policy against Russia. If Minsk is the only way to keep those sanctions on, then I think Minsk has to stay.
But the sanctions that have been renewed, if I'm not mistaken, by Europe, correct?
Correct.
No, they were promised to be...
Promised to be renewed. Have been renewed multiple times.
Yes, and they are still waiting. It seems to me that there is no cohesive policy towards sanctions here in the United States. We have a bipartisan support for renewing sanctions in the Congress, but unfortunately, the information that we are hearing from White House is not supporting that idea. And actually, Congress is trying to make sure that sanctions would become a law, and there are a couple of legislation in Congress to support a sanctions policy toward Russia in relations to Ukraine.
For now, it's an executive order which could be easily overturned by Mr. Trump should he desire. But just as Miroslava said, because of our checks and balances here in the United States, the Congress, and it seems there's a bipartisan push, as you just said, is willing to go much further and enact legislation.
Unfortunately, there is an issue that Mr. Trump can put veto on that legislation. Senator Rubio recently said that they have enough support to overcome that veto, but we will see.
Yes, and he will have to see. Well, back to Mr. Trump and the relationship between Russia, Mr. Trump and his coterie of advisors, and some of these right-wing parties in Europe, Alina. Now, some analysts say that the chief strategist of Mr. Trump, who sits in the White House, Stephen Bannon, has links from his days at Breitbart News, which is a right-wing nationalist website. He has links with some of these far-right parties in France and the Netherlands and Germany. Do you have evidence of concrete connections between him and these right-wing political parties?
Look, I'll be honest, there may be some ideological overlap there. Certainly in some speeches that Bannon has given, he has made remarks that put him, I think, clearly in line with the nationalist ideologies of these populist groups. He has also made positive remarks about Dugin, Alexander Dugin, who is an extremist ideologue in Russia who's not even in the mainstream within Russian politics, Mr. Putin. So it is interesting that Steve Bannon sees these movements or has made allusions to these movements as having a similar ideology to perhaps what his views are. In terms of seeing links beyond the ideological connections, there's not much evidence on that, to be honest with you. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but it's always difficult to point to that. You asked the question about the relationship between the populist parties and not just Bannon or the Trump administration, but particularly between the Kremlin and these populist parties. There we have a bit more evidence. One, we know that the National Front has been financed by Russian-backed sources in the past. They received a 9 million euro loan, and then after that asked for an additional loan, I believe, of 27 million euros from the Russian Federation to fund their political campaign. But experts believe that aside from this, other political parties are also receiving financial support, but following the money is incredibly difficult. And it's incredibly difficult, I think, intentionally, because from the Kremlin perspective, that's not how influence works best. Influence works best when these kinds of transactions are hidden, when they're unknown, because one, if a political leader, a political party is known to be in the pocket of the Kremlin or any other government, they're not taken as legitimate in their own domestic politics. But then, of course, if you have a legitimate, a credible political party that's gaining steam and gaining support, like the AfD in Germany, which you mentioned earlier, and they're not seen to be a lackey of the Kremlin yet, they hold very pro-Russian points of view. That is much more credible in terms of their own domestic agenda. And it benefits the Kremlin much more to have that kind of relationship than one that is so obviously quid pro quo.
Now, I know you don't have a crystal ball, Alina, but as we look into these elections in France, Netherlands, and Germany, do you see these populist nationalist parties making inroads and maybe even an outright victory in one or the other of these countries?
Well, I think it's certainly true that they will make greater inroads. The AfD right now has no seats in the German parliament, but they are polling at about 15%, which means that they will get quite a few seats in the German parliament next elections if they stay at this level. This will be the first time in Germany's history when a far-right party will once again enter the parliament, meaning since World War II. So this is a significant change in Germany specifically. And I think for Chancellor Merkel, that means she has a new challenge. She's never had to contest with a challenger on her right. So that's why I have concern about her party and the CDU. I think in France, French presidential elections, and typical, I think, French style, always full of drama and intrigue and scandal. Some of that's happening right now. The center-right candidate, François Fillon, has been tied up in a pretty massive corruption scandal. He was once the favorite candidate for the center-right Republicans to beat out Marine Le Pen in the presidential elections. But this thing might take him down, this corruption scandal. We'll wait and see. And then, of course, on the central left in France, we have Macron, who's arisen as a potential challenger to Le Pen. But what we've seen, and this goes back to this Russian influence question of why it matters, is that already on the internet, on news networks, on social media, there are trolls who are just trying to discredit Macron as much as possible. Because unlike Fillon, the center-right candidate, and unlike Le Pen, the far-right candidate, he's not pro-Russian and he's not pro-Kremlin. And so we're already seeing this disinformation machine once again start up to try to discredit a candidate that's seen as not a good one for the Kremlin, which is, of course, very similar to what we saw in the United States. So will these political forces win? I don't know, but they'll certainly make big gains.
But we have to remember as well that in Eastern Europe, there are far-right national parties winning as well. And we saw the rise of right nationals in Poland.
Hungary.
Hungary. Czech Republic is kind of on the verge. So Eastern Europe is actually kind of preoccupied with this right national sentiments, I would say.
I think you're right. I think one trend that we've also been observing is that when it comes to the rise in populism, I always make the point that it really started in Western Europe. These parties have been around since the 70s and the 50s in some cases, with the case of National Front, and also the case of the Austrian Freedom Party, for example. So they're old, seasoned political players. In Central Eastern Europe, these are relatively new parties, yet they've been able to control at a much faster rate than any of the far-right populists in Western Europe. So Viktor Orban's party, of course, PiS, the ruling party in Poland. These are parties that I would not necessarily put in the same category as Le Pen's National Front,
sure,
or even Geert Wilders' party in the Netherlands. I do think they are more centrist in some ways. For example, PiS, the Polish ruling party, is not against NATO. They're not pro-Russian, and they're not really against the EU in the same way that Le Pen's party is, where she's been calling for a French exit, a Frexit from the EU for a long time. So I think the situation in Central Eastern Europe, while tenuous and potentially indicative of broader trends towards what we can call illiberal democracies and democratic backsliding, it's not as worrisome to me in some ways, mainly because these political parties are still buying into the European project and NATO.
If the European project will still exist, we don't really know.
Okay, so what is the silver lining for the EU in all of this drama? And
look, I know we can...
EU and NATO, I would say, because the NATO question here is very serious as well, and White House is claiming that Europe have to pay fair shares.
Well, let me end on that and ask you, Alina Polyakova, is there some truth to these accusations made also by the previous president, President Obama, to the fact that Europe could step it up a bit?
Absolutely. I think out of all the things that President Trump said in the campaign trail, the comment about NATO is not completely out of line. Many European countries do not contribute what they agreed to contribute to their own security. They contribute in other ways, of course, but calling the Europeans to do more may not be such a bad thing. And I think if there's a silver lining here, I would just say that the European project has made it through some profound crises so far. And there is an underlying understanding among European leaders, and I think the European publics as well, that nationalism and Europe do not mix.
Alina Polyakova is Deputy Director of the Eurasia Center at the Atlantic Council and Senior Fellow in the Future Europe Initiative. Alina, thanks for coming in and sharing your terrific insights.
Thank you so much, Carol.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Kelvin Fowler. And joining me on the program was Miroslava Gongadze, Chief of VOA's Ukrainian Service. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.